So this is the second of two lectures on the theme of risk aversion and expected utility. In Monday's lecture, we looked at the idea of a simple lottery where there were two possible outcomes next period. That's where the risk lay. Today, we knew everything there was to know about each of those two outcomes next period. The only piece of information we didn't have was which of the two outcomes would occur. That's how we capture risk in this module. There's more than one possibility next period. We can describe each of those possible scenarios today in full, but today we don't know which of those scenarios will occur next period. The best we can do is attach probabilities to them. The scenarios that we have in mind take care of all possible outcomes next period, only one of which can occur, so the probabilities we allocate must add up to one. And we assume in this module, to keep the story simple, that everyone, all investors, agree about those probabilities, so they are objective, not subjective. What we really want to understand, of course, is how individuals make decisions in a risky world. And what we learned in Monday's lecture was they're not driven simply by considerations of wealth. An investor who's driven solely by considerations of wealth is happier, the wealthier they are. Well, that's certainly rational. If that describes the individual completely, that individual must be risk neutral, indifferent to risk. But our individuals are not simply rational, or to use the politically incorrect word, greedy. They're also fearful, or to use a better word, risk averse. When we're looking at rational risk averse individuals, when we want to try and understand their decision making, it's not good enough simply to look at the impact of the decision on their wealth, because that's not capturing anything about their attitude to risk. The way in which we take into account their views, their preferences regarding exposure to risk, is to work with the utility of wealth function. So if by any chance you were wondering, why are we using this utility of wealth concept, the answer is because we want to understand better the decision-making that risk-averse individuals make. They're driven not by the simple desire to be wealthier, they're driven by a desire to increase, ultimately to maximise, their expected utility of wealth. So the utility of wealth function is a very powerful tool, a very powerful concept for us, because that's what we're going to use to understand how individual investors will behave. That's why we have to do this. So the point that we finished up on at the end of Monday's lecture was to look at this graph. So if I can just remind you of the details again, along the horizontal is wealth. Now we're looking at outcomes next period. Remember, we don't know which of those two outcomes, or more than two outcomes in general, will occur. So wealth along the horizontal here is wealth next period. Today, we don't know what value that will take. In our simple lottery model, it can take one of two values. If the lottery, the gamble, turns out well for the investor, their wealth increases. Their wealth increases by the payoff to the gamble. So if their initial wealth today, which we know for sure, is W0, their wealth next period in that scenario is W0 plus the winnings from the lottery. Whereas, if the gamble goes against them, their wealth next period is less than what they started with today, because the payoff, as the graph implies, the payoff to the gamble is negative. So in this simple model, there are only two possible outcomes. That's enough for our purposes to capture the idea of risk. So the fact that there is a spread in possible wealths next period, that's enough for us to have risk in the story now. after. What we're really interested in is the value of the utility of wealth. Because our individual is rational, i.e. greedy, that utility of wealth function increases from left to right. Because our individual is risk-averse, the rate at which that utility of wealth function increases from left to right gets slower and slower. So the graph is increasing and concave. And so it will always be for our rational, risk-averse investors. We also introduced the concept last time of an actuarially fair gamble. And an individual who takes an actuarially fair gamble has as his or her expected wealth next period their initial wealth. In other words, if they were to take the gamble again and again many times, on average they would expect neither to end up better off or less well off. So that equation is reminding us that the gamble we're thinking about is fair, and that keeps the story nice and simple. But as I suggested to you on Monday, you might like to ask yourself, how would the story generalise if the gamble were not fair? That would be a degree of complication that I certainly don't want to have right now. Now, the main message behind this graph is the following. A risk-averse individual will always walk away from this gamble if, as I've set it up, he expects to be no better off following the gamble than he is currently. This is a problem for our risk-averse investor. Remember, his decision-making is not informed by what happens simply to his wealth. His decision-making is informed by what happens to his utility of wealth. Our investor, when he looks at this diagram, sees exactly what's going on. He recognises that were he to face an investment prospect that left him with wealth, W0, next period, for sure, no risk, the height of this point on the graph would indicate how happy he was. Whereas, how happy he expects to be after taking this gamble is determined by the height of this point. And clearly, that's not so high up. That's what that graph is actually telling us. It's telling us that a risk-averse individual would never accept an actuarially fair gamble with the same payoff, the same payoff as a for sure outcome. So what's the consequence of this? The consequence is when this investor looks at this gamble, the gamble that either leaves him better off by this amount or worse off by this amount, when the investor is faced by that gamble, he equates it in terms of his personal happiness with a different investment prospect, one that has a surefire outcome. He knows today for sure how wealthy he will be, but that surefire wealth next period is less than the expected wealth. It's less than his initial wealth. The fact that this so-called certainty equivalent wealth lies to the left of his initial wealth, his expected wealth, following the gamble, that's pointing up the fact this guy is risk-averse. Geometrically, it's happening because his utility of wealth function is concave. The other point to come from the diagram is now we have a measure of how risk-averse he is. The more risk-averse is the individual, the further to the left will this so-called certainty equivalent wealth lie compared to his initial wealth or expected wealth. So the bigger is that distance, the more risk-averse is the investor. And that's a meaningful measure of risk aversion because it's expressed in wealth terms. We can actually quantify it. We can talk about how big that distance is in measured in units of wealth, pounds sterling, US dollars, whatever. This distance we're going to give a name to. as you'll see shortly. It's a risk premium. We're going to call it the Markowitz risk premium, after the person that first thought of it. And we're going to meet the name Markowitz again in a later lecture next week. So the next slide in the story summarises what's going on in that diagram. Now, it depends on how you learn best. If the way you work best is to read the slide and take on board the words, and that's how you start to understand it, that's fine. If that's the case, then this slide does all the work for you. For me personally, I find it a lot easier to work with the picture in mind. The two slides are saying the same thing, and you need to know all of those pieces of information. But that's not enough for our purposes. We also want to understand better what's going on. So let me take you back to something I said on Monday. What if, for example, the utility of wealth function involves the negative exponential of wealth? Now, I wrote down a particular functional form. And that functional form, if I can remind you, it's an example. That functional form looked like this. The important point about what I've written down there is I've introduced a parameter little a that characterises the degree of risk aversion, and we'll come to understand that better after we've worked through the seminar material next week. What you should be able to do immediately is look at that diagram and ask yourself, how does the shape of the graph change as you adjust the value of little a? Well, I showed you in the lecture on Monday, I showed you that basically, if you start to turn up the value of little a, then the graph will bend like so. The higher is the value of little a, the more curvature there is in the shape of the utility of wealth graph. But do you see that we can now interpret that what that means is the investor is more risk averse, because if we crank up the value of little a so that the graph moves outwards to the left and up, I hope you see now that the certainty equivalent wealth is pushed further to the left. And therefore, the risk premium that I'm talking about gets bigger. So now we've seen an example of how we can start to use the utility of wealth function to characterise the degree of risk aversion, and we know we're talking about risk aversion because you see the effect on the diagram. You see that what's happening is the investor, as we crank up the value of little a in this case, the investor is demanding a larger premium, a larger risk premium. Now, what is that risk premium? In this context, actually, it's a measure of how much money. It's money because the risk premium represents a distance along the wealth axis. How much money is that investor prepared to spend on insurance to protect him against the risk in the gamble? This distance is the maximum that that investor would be willing to pay for an insurance policy that completely covers him against the unknown outcome of this gamble. So there's the interpretation of the Markowitz risk premium that I want you to take on board. So summarising on this slide then, what makes the problem interesting is the following. That whenever the individual is risk averse, the utility of wealth graph is shaped like this, and a consequence of that is the following, that the utility of wealth he would have if he was facing a surefire outcome that left his wealth unchanged would be this much, whereas the expected utility he has from taking the gamble is only this much. There is it expressed in mathematical terms. The fact that this point is not as high up as that point is a graphical illustration of what's known as Jensen's inequality. And Jensen's inequality is always true when we're looking at a risk-averse investor. So you need to know that. Our definition of certainty equivalent wealth then, let's look at the diagram. The certainty equivalent wealth is the surefire wealth for which the utility of wealth equals the expected utility for the gamble. These two points are at the same height. So that's what that's saying. The height of the utility of wealth function, when we're looking at the certainty equivalent wealth, that height is the same as the height of this point, and that is what the investor expects his utility of wealth to be following the gamble. So this definition of certainty equivalent, you need to know. Now put these two statements together and deduce, therefore, this inequality. And then remember that the investor is rational or greedy, and therefore the graph is always increasing from left to right, and therefore you can deduce that the certainty equivalent itself must lie to the left of the expected wealth. Do you see how it's all coming together? The fact that the investor is risk-averse is what makes the graph concave, and that in turn gives rise to Jensen's inequality. The fact that the investor is rational or greedy is what makes the graph always increase from left to right. So if the utility of the certainty equivalent wealth is less than the utility of the expected future wealth, then these two individual wealths must also stack up like that. So I can be sure that the certainty equivalent wealth lies to the left of the expected wealth. That means that the difference between the two, expected wealth after the gamble minus certainty equivalent wealth, is a positive number. And that's why I refer to it as a premium. It's a risk premium. And it's known as the Markowitz risk premium. And here is the next definition, if you like, that you have to remember. Now, as I say, if you prefer to take on board all of this by reading the slide and remembering the definitions, that's fine. Just make sure you don't get them wrong. Make sure you don't get them back to front. Personally, I find it a lot easier to work with the diagram because I understand the diagram. I understand the message that the diagram is giving me. You'll see in next week's seminar that I've set you some questions where I ask you to calculate the certainty equivalent wealth. And that begs the question, how do you do that then? Well, you find the certainty equivalent wealth by solving this equation. Where does this equation come from? Well, by definition of certainty equivalent, the utility of wealth, when we're looking at the certainty equivalent wealth, is the same as the expected utility of the gamble. The expected utility of the gamble equals the utility of the certainty equivalent wealth. So if I set you a question that asks you to determine the certainty equivalent wealth, what I'm actually saying to you is, write down this equation and solve it. In order for you to be able to do that, what you've got to do first of all is find the expected utility of wealth. And you'll see that in the examples for next week's seminar, that's what you're asked to do earlier on in the question. So I give you details about the gamble, i.e. I tell you what are the possible outcomes next period. If you like, what are the possible values of wealth next period? How likely is each of those outcomes? So I'm giving you the probabilities. I tell you the utility of wealth function. If I don't tell you that, you can't go any further. Now you've got enough information to work out this quantity. We reminded ourselves in the very first lecture, the basics lecture, how we calculate expected value. The only complication here is it's not expected future wealth, it's expected utility of wealth. But once you know the utility of wealth function, it's no more difficult. So you start by working out that quantity. And then you solve this equation for the so-called certainty equivalent wealth. And once you've done that, you can then deduce the Markowitz risk premium. So you've got a measure in wealth terms of how risk-averse this individual is. That's the general pattern to some of the questions in next week's seminar. And if that doesn't motivate you, then maybe the next sentence will. this is very good fodder for an exam question. Here I've extracted from this more complicated diagram a little aide-mémoire of what's going on along the horizontal axis. And again, I find that useful just to keep me right. The gamble that we will consider is usually a fair gamble. Therefore, this must be true. So the expected future wealth equals the initial wealth. So that's me anchored the value of expected future wealth. Typically, there are only two possible outcomes. It could be worse. But if there are only two possible outcomes, they situate themselves on either side of the expected future wealth. There's the winning outcome, there's the losing outcome. Of course, the real thing I'm concerned about is, where is the certainty equivalent? You should never fall into the trap of thinking the certainty equivalent wealth sits over here. It doesn't. It always sits to the left of the expected wealth, and the difference between the two is the mark of its risk premium. Okay, let's do an example. So this is a particular individual. Now again, you have to wait till you try the seminar questions to get a better idea of exactly what sort of risk preferences has this individual got. All I'm saying to you at the moment is the way in which we're modelling those risk preferences is by assuming that the utility of wealth function for this guy, well, is going to be a logarithmic wealth. So let's set the problem up. The guy starts with initial wealth of 500. So that's before he takes the gamble. It's the same gamble as we had in Monday's lecture. So he's either going to end up £50 in the black, £50 up, or £50 down in the red. Okay? So what are the two possible outcomes? If the gamble turns out in his favour, he gains £50, so his wealth next period is £550. If the gamble goes against him, he's down £50, so his wealth next period is £450. The gamble is assumed fair, so the expected future wealth is his initial wealth. His initial wealth is £500. So that's how the diagram stacks up. Okay. I can't do any more until and unless I define for you the utility of wealth function. So I'd better do that. So now I tell you the utility of wealth function is the logarithmic function. And the first thing you should be thinking to yourself is, what's the shape of that graph? You've got to be reassured in your mind the graph has the correct properties. It increases from left to right, so as you increase W, so does U of W increase, and it's concave. If it isn't either of them, we're in trouble. Okay, so what does the problem involve? What we want to do is evaluate the investor's risk premium. How do we do that? Well, the first thing we do is calculate the expected utility of wealth. Let's go back and just remind ourselves what's going on. Two possible outcomes next period. He either ends up with a wealth of 550 or a wealth of 450. Because we're tossing a fair coin, the two outcomes are equally likely. So the two probabilities are each equal to a half. Let's just pause in case we fall into a trap. I want you to notice that the investor's utility function is a utility of wealth, not a utility of payout from the gamble. And that's a common mistake that students make. What we're evaluating is the value of U of W. So let's be careful. It's the utility function when W is 550, not 50. Or it's the utility function when W is 450, not minus 50. A common mistake is to forget that the utility function we're talking about is utility of future wealth. That is itself initial wealth plus the outcome of the gamble. If the gamble adds 50 to his wealth increases by 50. If the gamble takes away 50 from his wealth decreases. But what we need in the calculation of expected utility of wealth are the values of future wealth. So be careful. Don't fall into the trap of thinking that should be minus 50 and that should be plus 50. A very common mistake I see in an exam answer is a student forgets that and writes here, or would write, 1/2 log minus 50 plus 1/2 log of 50, doesn't know what to do when faced with the log of a negative number, forgets it doesn't make sense,
and decides, oh well, I'll just ignore the minus sign, it's not going to do much harm, is it? And of course ends up with a totally wrong answer. So let's be clear that what's sitting in here is future wealth in each of the two scenarios, the win scenario and the lose scenario. The rest of this calculation is trivial. You use your calculator to get the value of expected utility of wealth. Ask yourself, what are the units here? And don't fall into the trap of thinking they are units of wealth, because they're not. They're units of utility, and I haven't told you what they are. Economists sometimes find it useful to talk in terms of so many utils. I don't use any units. Let's just be clear, we're not talking in wealth terms now. We're talking in terms of units of utility. What do we want? We want the certainty equivalent wealth. So you have to solve this equation. You know the utility of wealth function, it's the logarithm. So on the left hand side is just the log of the certainty equivalent wealth. On the right hand side is the expected utility of wealth after having taken the gamble, and we've just worked out that that is 6.210. So the rest of this part of the calculation is just solving that equation. How do you get rid of the log? Well, you exponentiate both sides, because log and exponential are inverse functions of one another. Now we're back in wealth terms. This certainty equivalent is 497.49 units of wealth. So if we're working in pounds sterling, this certainty equivalent wealth is £497.49. We're in wealth terms because we're back down on the horizontal axis. What's the next most common mistake I see? The next most common mistake I see is something's gone wrong in the preceding algebra, and the student has got an answer for the certainty equivalent that's bigger than the expected wealth. In other words, bigger than the initial wealth. In other words, in this case, an answer that's bigger than 500, and again, they don't spot that something must be wrong. Because we're looking at a risk-averse investor, we know to expect that this certainty equivalent wealth will be less than the expected wealth, which, because it's a fair gamble, is the same thing as the initial wealth. So you should know mentally to check. You get an answer that's less than 500, and if you don't, something's gone wrong. If you got an answer that was bigger than 500 and you didn't spot something's wrong, then you're in real trouble in the final step of the calculation, because when you come to calculate the risk premium, you're going to get a negative number. And what students tend to do in that situation is just ignore the minus sign and not recognise that something else has gone wrong earlier in the calculation. These little mental checks will help you not to make any mistakes. Why do you care about not making mistakes? Because if this is part of a question in the exam, this is easy pickings. This is a set of steps that you can get to grips with, you can learn off pat. I'd like you also to understand what you're doing, and you can start to run up some very useful marks in the exam if there is a question on this. So really, this is something that I expect everyone, you might need a little bit of practice in next week's seminars, but after next week's seminars, this is something I expect that everyone can do, standing on their head, and if you can't, it's only because you can't stand on your head. That's the only reason. So, we come to the conclusion then that this individual's risk premium, Markovic's risk premium, is £2.51. What's the interpretation? If confronted by a risky gamble like this, this guy would be prepared to pay up to £2.51 for an insurance contract that completely took away the risk of the gamble. Now, what do I mean by completely took away the risk of the gamble? I mean, once he's bought that insurance contract, he knows for sure that his wealth next period will be the same as his initial wealth minus the cost of the insurance. He'd rather have that surefire knowledge. So that's the interpretation to attach to this number. He would pay up to that for insurance that will completely wipe away the uncertainty in how big his wealth will be next period. Okay. This is our final concept today, but we've got to spend a little bit of time on it because it's the intuition that matters as much as the formalism. Let's go back to this equation. If you've forgotten where it comes from, remind yourself. That's why I've left the diagram on the other screen. Remind yourself of the definition of the certainty equivalent wealth. The certainty equivalent wealth is that surefire wealth next period for which the utility of wealth is the same as the expected utility of wealth following the gamble. That's what that's saying. All I've done on the right-hand side is I've replaced certainty equivalent by expected future wealth minus Markowitz risk premium. Let's jump to the final slide and sweat about the algebra, because you need to know this algebra. I could ask you to prove this result. I could ask you to come up with the formula. So there's our starting point then, which, as I remind you again, reflects the definition of certainty equivalent. Now think about how we are modelling risk. The individual starts with an initial wealth W0. He takes the gamble. The outcome of the gamble is uncertain. The outcome of the gamble I am labelling by epsilon. And in my simple lottery example, epsilon is either takes a positive value or a negative value. In the coin tossing experiment, it was either plus 50 or minus 50. So epsilon, we don't know the value of epsilon today. Epsilon is how much does his wealth change following the outcome of the gamble. So let's substitute wherever we see W in this first equation. Let's substitute that by initial wealth plus uncertain outcome of the gamble. And we get that. How do we get from this line to the line below? We remind ourselves that the gamble is fair. So you might want to make a note of that. The gamble is fair, so in expectation, the value of epsilon is zero. In other words, many, many repeated trials of the gamble neither result in a positive nor a negative outcome. So the expected value of epsilon is zero, so it disappears. So now we have this equation. I can't do any more until and unless I remember how Taylor series work. And for those of you that came to the Maths and Stats Review last Thursday evening, I said to you, the reason I need you to know Taylor series is at some point in the lectures on risk aversion and expected utility, I'm going to have to make use of them. So now they start to work for us. So now we're going to expand the left-hand side and the right-hand side as Taylor series. So how's this going to work? In the square brackets, expand this function as a Taylor series. That's what I'm doing down here. And that's assumed knowledge. I assume you can do that for yourself. You need to know how to do that. So as I showed those of you that came last Thursday, we're expanding about the value of W equal to our initial wealth. We're expanding in powers of epsilon. Remember, epsilon is the unknown outcome of the gamble. It's unknown today. And then I start to sweep through this expression with this so-called expectation operator, making use of this property. So you should be saying to yourself as you work through the algebra, so this is only true if the gamble's fair. If the gamble were not fair, we couldn't do this. So if I were to ask you as part of an exam question, what might not hold if the gamble were no longer assumed to be fair, this would be your point of entry to answering that. Because clearly, we're assuming the gamble is fair. When this expectation operator hits this factor of epsilon, it vanishes because of that result. Okay. What about this term? Well, I've got to do a little bit more work there. I need to know a little bit more statistics. So, let's do it. Here's something else I need you to know from stats. I told you what the definition of variance of returns, in this case variance of a variable that's called epsilon, variance is a probability weighted average of squared deviations from the mean. So when I write down the expression for the variance of this uncertain outcome epsilon, what I'm actually looking at is, by how much does each possible value of epsilon differ from the expected value of epsilon? I take each of those deviations and I square them, and then I work out the probability weighted average. But hang on. Yet again, I'm assuming that my gamble is fair. So wherever I encounter the expected value of epsilon, it disappears. It's zero. So, for this particular random variable, its variance is the same thing as the expected squared value. Now, the expected value of epsilon squared is exactly what I've got in this term. As I sweep through with my expectation operator and I encounter epsilon squared, the expected value of epsilon squared is just the same thing as the variance of epsilon. So what's happening on the left-hand side? The following. The first term is trivial. I know initial wealth for sure. There's nothing to calculate. Its expected value is the utility of initial wealth. So that term just preserves as U of W naught. The next term on the left disappears, thanks to the gamble being fair, because the expected value of epsilon is zero. The third, and that's the only other term I'm going to retain on the left-hand side, the expected value of epsilon squared is the same thing as the variance of epsilon. So this term now reads 1 half times the second derivative of the utility function evaluated at W naught times the variance of epsilon. Keep that in mind. What's going on the right-hand side of the equation? Well, again, it's a Taylor series expansion. The first term is just U of W naught, and that's going to cancel with this U of W naught. So they're going to go away. The second term, and this is as far as I'm going on the right-hand side, the second term looks like this. It brings in the first derivative of U of W. So once I've mopped everything up, what am I left with? On the left-hand side, I'm left with 1 half times the second derivative of the function U of W naught times the variance of epsilon. And on the right-hand side, I'm left with minus the first derivative of the utility of wealth function evaluated when W is W naught times what I really want, which is the Markowitz risk premium. Tidy up that to make the Markowitz risk premium the subject, and I've got an approximate formula for the Markowitz risk premium. Now, why do I say it's approximate? I say it's approximate because I'm disregarding these higher order terms. So what needs to be true then? What needs to be true is that values of epsilon, in some sense, are small. So this is what's often referred to as a local approximation. So for this to work, for this to be a good approximation, we're going to look at relatively small gambles. Gambles in which the possible outcomes, so the changes in wealth, are relatively small compared to the initial wealth. Now, how small is small depends on the individual investor. But what we've come up with here is a formula for approximating the Markowitz risk premium. Now, why might we want that? It might be the case that this is not an easy equation to solve. Sure, I'm not going to ask you anything in a class test or an exam that's mathematically intractable. But how tractable or not the equation is to solve will clearly depend on the utility of wealth function. If we've got a nasty, a rather complicated utility of wealth function, this might be a bit of a pain to solve. So instead, we'll make do with a good approximation for the Markowitz risk premium, and that's this expression. And yes, you need to know that formula. This approximation is known as the Pratt Arrow, after the two economists who first came up with it. This is the Pratt Arrow approximation to the Markowitz risk premium, and it's a good approximation when the size of the gamble is small relative to the investor's initial wealth. How do we measure size of the gamble? Answer, by the variance of epsilon, or if you prefer, the standard deviation. So you look at the standard deviation of epsilon and compare it to W naught. Now, What typical ratio constitutes small versus big? It depends on the investor's risk preferences, but I would suggest to you that something in the region of 10 to 15% is probably still reasonably small. If it's getting bigger than that, you're not looking at a particularly small gamble, and in which case this is not a particularly good approximation. So what is it you need to know? You need to know the formula for the Pratt-Arrow approximation to the Markowitz risk premium. You also need to know under what conditions it's a good approximation. And the answer is basically when you're faced with small gambles. But now comes the important intuition. When you look at this formula, you start to see a story, I hope. Remember, on the left-hand side is the risk premium. And the risk premium is what's measuring the degree of risk aversion. Look at this factor on the left, on the right-hand side. That involves the utility of wealth function, sure. It involves both the first derivative and the second derivative. So what's going on here? What's going on here is those two properties of the utility of wealth function are describing the degree of risk aversion that this investor exhibits. This is what we call the coefficient of absolute risk aversion. And that's defined in one of the seminar questions next week. And there's a question that gives you an opportunity to work at it. Just to confuse you, there's also something called the coefficient of relative risk aversion. But let's wait till we get to the seminar before we worry about that. What I want you to start to pick up on is the following. That what is driving the size of the risk premium are two distinct factors. One is the attitude of the investor to risk. And that's captured by this expression. Now let's think about it. The investor is rational or greedy, so the utility of wealth function is always increasing from left to right, so the first derivative is positive. The investor is risk averse, so the utility of wealth function has a concave graph, so the second derivative is always negative. The minus sign out front soaks up that negative value of the second derivative, so the whole expression in the square brackets is always positive. And that's what's capturing how risk averse the investor is. The other factor that contributes to the size of the risk premium is how risky is the gamble itself? Do you see the intuition coming at you from the formula? That what is determining how much will this investor be prepared to pay for insurance against the risk inherent in the gamble reflects two factors. What is his or her attitude to risk? And that's captured by this so-called coefficient of absolute risk aversion. And secondly, by how big is the gamble? Now go back to something I said to you in Monday's lecture. I asked you to think about how does an investor react when faced with gambles of a fixed size? Well, now you can start to answer that. Now you can start to understand one of the bullet points in Monday's lecture. Because suppose we're looking at the same investor at different points in his life. How does he react when he's confronted with the same gamble, the same degree of risk? So let's fix the variance of epsilon. That doesn't change. Suppose the investor gets wealthier as he gets older. The investor gets wealthier as he gets older. This expression is going to change. Now it depends on the precise form of the utility of wealth function. If that utility of wealth function changes in this pattern, this coefficient of absolute risk aversion may get smaller as he gets wealthier. Therefore, he will demand a smaller risk premium. He will be less resistant to taking on risk. So that, I hope, gives you some intuition behind the statement I made rather baldly on Monday, that if the coefficient of absolute risk aversion decreases with wealth, if the measure of risk aversion decreases with wealth, that investor is going to be more inclined to take a punt when faced with a gamble of fixed size. Why do I call this the coefficient of absolute risk aversion? After all, when you do the seminar question, you're also going to be confronted with a related concept called coefficient of relative risk aversion. Why is this absolute risk aversion? And the answer is because this expression here is a measure of, is an absolute measure of how risky the gamble is. If instead we were to look at how big is the gamble compared to the investor's initial wealth, so now imagine I divide this factor by W naught. In order not to change anything, I'll have to multiply inside here, say, by W naught, so they cancel. Now I'm looking at how the risk premium changes as the relative size of the gamble changes. The size of the gamble relative to the investor's initial wealth. If that's more useful, and it depends on the context, then we'll work with something called the coefficient of relative risk aversion. And as you'll see from next week's seminar, when we're looking at relative risk aversion, there's an extra factor of W sitting in there. And the reason that W is there is to cancel out the W that would appear down here if it's more useful to us to think in terms of relative size. It depends on the context.